The Tom Woods Show, episode 451.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, you're looking to learn a new language? There are obvious places to go to do so, but I find, for my money, by far the best is Rocket Languages, because I learn not just a bunch of words, but how the language works. You can get a free mini course and check them out for nothing through tomwoods.com/rocket. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I hinted yesterday at what today's topic was going to be, but now that I think about it, I really didn't at all. I told you that Gene Epstein had sort of given me an idea, but I didn't give you the details. Well, I think you're really going to like this one. What I'm doing today is sharing with you an article that I would say 99.999% of you have never read, and maybe 90% of you have never heard of. And both of those are a terrible shame, and we're going to rectify that today. Because this article I want to talk to you about is from the summer of 1994, and it's written by Eugene Genovese, who is deceased now, but at that time was an ex-Marxist who had spent his life as a Marxist and as a supporter, a frank supporter of the Soviet Union and of international communism. And in this article that he wrote for Dissent magazine, he calls the article The Question. And he poses this question: what did you know, and when did you know it? Now, I bet my older listeners will have a sense of what he means by that question. In other words, when you were promoting international communism, how much did you know about the atrocities being carried out by communist regimes, and at what point did you find that out? Very, very good question, a question that really has not been asked of anyone, though, of course, if we were talking about Hitler and the Nazis, it would be asked all the time. Why there's an exception made for communism is an interesting question, and he's looking to find out what the answer is from his fellow leftists. And the thing is, this article, I'm going to link to it, of course, on the show notes page. The show notes page for today is tomwoods.com/451. You should read it for yourselves. You should pass it on to people. Now, I'm going to read big chunks of it to you and then comment on it, just because as I was looking over it this morning, looking for passages I wanted to share, I thought the whole thing is a passage I want to share. This is one of the most beautifully and devastatingly written articles I have ever seen. And as you know, all I do is read. So this thing is good. So we're going to have some fun going over this. First of all, who was Eugene Genovese? He was a U.S. historian who wrote from a Marxist perspective. He was a 20th century historian, died, I don't remember offhand, but it was in the early 21st century. I had a chance to interview him for a magazine I used to write for back in the late 1990s. This was after he had made his conversion, so to speak, away from Marxism. And he was a historian primarily of the American South, and he was also a great historian of American slavery. He wrote, for example, one of the books of his that I read, a book on the slavery question, was called Roll, Jordan, Roll, The World the Slaves Made. And what a compelling subtitle that is, isn't it? The World the Slaves Made. The idea of that book was that the slaves are so often depicted as these passive actors in history. Like the slaves were over there, and the abolitionists were trying to free them, and the slaveholders were trying to keep them in bondage. But we don't think much about what they were doing. But he gives them, to use a kind of fashionable left-wing term, agency in this book, Roll, Jordan, Roll. He shows how they did, in fact, build a world for themselves. They did, in fact, resist in very interesting ways. So that's definitely worth checking out. Now, bear in mind, Roll, Jordan, Roll is a great work of history in the same way that Moby Dick is a great work of literature. That you know in the abstract it's a great work, but you want to gouge your eyes out while you're reading it. I remember reading Roll, Jordan, Roll as a college sophomore, and I just pretty much wanted to end it all trying to make my way through this book. So I want you to understand it's a contribution in that it brings a lot of great things to light, but I don't particularly recall it being a page turner, and I don't want you to be disappointed and blame me that I ruined your life by recommending this book. I just want you to know about it. A book he wrote about the American South after he had come to have second thoughts about Marxism was called The Southern Tradition, and I will link to both of those at tomwoods.com/451. He actually came and spoke at Harvard and gave a series of lectures in 1993 that later became the book The Southern Tradition. I went to those lectures because I was a student at Harvard till 1994. Everybody who was anybody was at those lectures. All these Harvard professors, they were all there. And he said right to them, right in their faces, he said, you know, what I find is if I go and give a speech on Southern history down at some podunk Southern college, I better watch every comma and semicolon because they're going to know everything and they're going to call me on it. He said, whereas if I come give a speech on Southern history in the Ivy League, don't worry, nobody's going to know anything. He said that. I mean, I love it. He's like the Donald Trump of the historical profession. He just says things you can't believe he's saying. He said them. All right, so a very accomplished historian. He writes this article, and as I say, the question is, what did you know and when did you know it? And here's how he begins evaluating that question. He says, at the age of 15, I became a communist. And although expelled from the party in 1950 at age 20, I remained a supporter of the international movement and of the Soviet Union until there was nothing left to support. And then, I love this, he goes on and says, now, as everyone knows, in a noble effort to liberate the human race from violence and oppression, we broke all records for mass slaughter, piling up tens of millions of corpses in less than three quarters of a century. When the Asian figures are properly calculated, the aggregate to our credit may reach the seemingly incredible numbers widely claimed. Those who are big on multiculturalism might note that the great majority of our victims were non-white. And by the way, isn't it interesting that people who are so interested, claim to be so interested in multiculturalism, have zero interest in the crimes of communism? So they're sort of interested in multiculturalism, but not really. All right, so then he says, never having been much good at math, I shy away from quibbles over statistics. Still, all quibbles aside, we have a disquieting number of corpses to account for. Then later on, he goes on to say that it, especially amusing in all this, has been the spectacle of people who pronounce themselves anti-Stalinists and denounce the socialist countries at every turn, and yet even today applaud each new revolution, although any damn fool has to know that most of them will end in the same place. Then he continues, for that matter, how could we have survived politically were it not for the countless liberals who, to one extent or another, supported us, apparently under the comforting delusion that we were social reformers in rather too much of a hurry, a delusion we ourselves never suffered from. Genovese recalls an event at the American Enterprise Institute. He was invited there to reflect on the collapse of the socialist countries. And he said, I summoned up whatever capacity I have for dissembling in an effort to deflect the one question I did not want to answer. I did not want to answer it before a right-wing audience because I feared I would unleash my Sicilian temper and counterattack with the litany of the crimes of the imperialists and their insufferable apologists. I began, it is a great pleasure to be with you today. Although since I claim expertise only as a historian of the Old South, I speak on current issues with trepidation. I do hope that your invitation carries no sadistic intent, that you do not expect an autobiographical mea culpa. For while it is true that I have been a Marxist and a bitter end supporter of the Soviet Union, I dislike autobiographies and admire the CIA's noble dictum, admit nothing, explain nothing, apologize for nothing. He says the audience responded with good-natured laughter and says, generally speaking, right-wingers are decidedly more courteous than we of the left and would not think of abusing their guests, as I probably would have abused them if challenged. And he says that they, although they laid some tough questions on him, they never asked him the question. Now, Genovese says that he didn't want to go in front of right-wing audiences and apologize because he felt like the right-wing audiences also had a lot to answer for. In the same way. So he recalls an episode in which he's talking to a well-known left-wing journalist over dinner, and he remarked upon the corpses. And the journalist said to him, You of all people are getting masochistic? And Genovese said, no, I'm not getting masochistic. I'm not about to cringe before right-wingers who supported numerous imperialist slaughters or social democrats whose responsible and moderate governments aided and abetted them. Yes, I do remember the glorious record of the bourgeoisie and the slave trade and the plantation colonies and the mass murders in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. I do recall that the Holocaust was not our doing. I still burn at the indifference with which virtually the whole American public received the reports of 250,000 Indonesian workers and peasants butchered in the 1960s, not in a civil war, but in their beds. And I know the rest. No, I would not stand still for the question from those people and would probably tell them what I have always told my classes. Your side has had its mass murderers, and we have had ours. And then, to give you a sense of how provocative Genovese can be, if he hasn't been provocative enough already, he wonders why what he calls our liberal colleagues refuse to single us out by asking the question. Maybe it's their knowledge of the record of imperialist atrocities on the other side. He said, but I'm afraid not. After all, they never stop asking Southern whites about their crimes, real and imagined, against blacks. And let's face it, Genovese says, all the combined crimes of white Southerners, at least if we restrict ourselves to the period since emancipation, would be worth no more than a footnote in a casebook that starred us. And anybody who questions that obviously needs to study the history of communism. Genovese recalls an effort that was undertaken by the Organization of American Historians, which I had to belong to in grad school just for professional purposes, but I got out of it as soon as I possibly could. I mean, these are the worst of the worst. And he said this effort involved condemning apartheid in South Africa. So in the OAH and other professional associations, Genovese says, Professor Wilborn Washburn, he means Wilcome Washburn, that's either a typo or a mistake, resolutely opposed this politicization and attempted to expose its hypocrisy by offering an amendment to condemn the necklacing of black South Africans, including children, by the militants of the African National Congress, which was a communist group. And for those of you who've forgotten, necklacing was execution by burning the victims alive. So could we at least also condemn that? The ANC, the African National Congress, subsequently repudiated this practice as being not only wrong but barbarous. The OAH has yet to endorse that repudiation. The Organization of American Historians hasn't quite caught up with the communists who have admitted that they were barbarous. I laughed, said Genovese. Those bloody South African whites did kill a lot of blacks and ought to answer for it. But throughout their whole history, they probably never equaled the numbers we put up in one of our more spirited month's work. I laughed even harder when our liberal colleagues poured out their wrath on the ghastly racists in South Africa, while they remained silent about the immeasurably greater slaughters occasioned by the periodic ethnic cleansing that was and is going on in black Africa and every other part of the globe. The New York Times recently announced that the death toll in the latest round of ethnic cleansing in Burundi has reached 150,000, with the fate of 500,000 or so refugees in doubt. The historical associations have not been heard from, nor should anyone expect that they will be. Just devastating, right? Just crushes them. What can they possibly say? What can they possibly say in response to this? Now, we can't pose or answer the question, said many leftists, because this is just a ploy to deflect attention, in the words of Genovese, from the oppression of women, gays, and other beleaguered minorities. Scholars in our own ranks have shown precious little interest in reflecting seriously on the collapse of the socialist countries we supported to the bitter end, or on any personal responsibilities we might have for the occasional unpleasantness that led to so sad a denouement. And he says, now, maybe you could make a case, some kind of case, to justify mass slaughters as the necessary price to be paid for a grand human liberation. Well, is that what we got, is what Genovese wants to know. Did we get the grand liberation? We broke a lot of eggs, but where's the omelet? He goes on to say, during the communist revolution of 1919 in Hungary, Sigmund Freud startled his friends by announcing that he had become half a Bolshevik. One of his communist students explained that the revolution would mean oceans of blood, out of which would come a just and humane society. Freud became half a Bolshevik. he declared his belief in every word of the first half. There'd be oceans of blood, all right. In retrospect, says Genovese, Freud looks good and we not so good. Our justification began to look seedy when the Grand Liberation featured hideous political regimes under which no sane person would want to live. It became preposterous when our project ended in the ignominious collapse of the social system that was supposed to undergird a brave new world and justify the staggering sacrifice of human life. He says that leftists have done a terrible job, or no job at all, in confronting the economic failures of these regimes and proposing a viable alternative to capitalism that wouldn't be this. And he says, no one should be surprised that none of our leading historical associations have thought it intellectually challenging to devote sessions at their enormous annual meetings to frank discussions of the socialist debacle. We of the left are regularly invited to give papers on just about any subject except this one. We are not asked to assess the achievements as well as the disasters, the heroism as well as the crimes, and the lessons we ourselves have learned from a tragic experience. No one need be surprised that we have never been called upon to explain ourselves. The pezzo novanti of our profession have more important things on their minds when they can take time away from their primary concern, the distribution of jobs, prizes, and other forms of patronage. They are immersed in grave condemnations of the appalling violations of human rights by Christopher Columbus. I know that it is in bad taste to laugh, but I laugh anyway. I would rather be judged boorish than be seen throwing up. He goes on to say that he doesn't feel compelled to answer right-wingers, although he's not even sure that he's right not to answer them. But he is sure that leftists have to answer to each other, to the movement to which we have devoted our lives, he says, and especially to the millions of our comrades who were themselves slaughtered in a heroic effort to make the world a better place. And then he answers the question, what did we know, and when did we know it? We knew everything essential and knew it from the beginning. This short answer will doubtless be hotly contested by the substantial number of left-wingers now ensconced in the academic establishment. I can hear them now. Where does Genovese get off speaking for us? Yes, he himself always knew. He never even had the decency to pretend not to know. He thereby proved himself the cad we have always known him to be. But we ourselves never even imagined that we were hearing anything more than the usual stories circulated by imperialists and reactionaries. Honest. And Genovese says that if these people insist on pleading ignorance, they ruin themselves, especially the historians among them, for they thereby admit to a willful refusal to examine the evidence that had been piled high from the beginning. Thus they confess to professional incompetence. I counsel against such a plea, for it would constitute grounds for revocation of tenure. But now we come to how it happened. How did the atrocities happen? And here, I just want to share with you the rest of the article. And remember, you can check it out for yourselves at tomwoods.com/451. So here he begins. The horrors did not arise from perversions of radical ideology, but from the ideology itself. We were led into complicity with mass murder and the desecration of our professed ideals, not by Stalinist or other corruptions of high ideals, much less by unfortunate twists in some presumably objective course of historical development, but by a deep flaw in our very understanding of human nature, its frailty and its possibilities, and by our inability to replace the moral and ethical baseline long provided by the religion we have dismissed with indifference, not to say contempt. The question of moral responsibility has been raised within the left, if gingerly and indirectly, by a few brave souls like Roberto Mangabeira Unger and Cornell West, who have drawn attention to the price we have paid for scouting Christian ethics while having nothing to substitute, and who have, in effect, called for an end to the blind hatreds that confuse the sin with the sinner. Unger and West are justly revered figures on the left and accorded at least formal respect. Yet their efforts toward a reassessment of the religious foundations of political ethics have not sparked the slightest discussion. It is fair to ask, what kind of respect is that? Are we supposed to believe that Unger and West have been kidding? Our whole project of human liberation has rested on a series of gigantic illusions. The catastrophic consequences of our failure during this century, not merely the body count, but the monotonous recurrence of despotism and wanton cruelty, cannot be dismissed as aberrations. Slimmed down to a technologically appropriate scale, they have followed in the wake of victories by radical egalitarian movements throughout history. We have yet to answer our right-wing critics' claims, which are regrettably well documented, that throughout history, from ancient times to the peasant wars of the 16th century, to the reign of terror and beyond, social movements that have espoused radical egalitarianism and participatory democracy have begun with mass murder and ended in despotism. Let us grant, arguendo, that the ruling classes have done worse. Whatever solace that thought may give us, our own problem remains. What kind of society could we build on a worldview marred by flagrant irrationalities paraded as self-evident truths, even if reinforced by sandbox cries of "you're another"? The allegedly high ideals we placed at the center of our ideology and politics are precisely what need to be re-examined, but they can no longer even be made a subject for discussion in the mass media and our universities, to say nothing of the left itself. They are givens: an unattainable equality of condition, a radical democracy that has always ended in the tyranny it is supposed to overcome, a celebration of human goodness or malleability, accompanied by the daily announcement of newly discovered inalienable rights to personal self-expression, destruction of all hierarchy and elites, as if ideological repudiation has ever prevented or ever could prevent the formation and reformation of hierarchies and elites, condemnation of illegitimate authority in the absence of any notion of what might constitute legitimate authority, and at the root of it all, a thorough secularization of society, bolstered by the monstrous lie that the constitutional separation of church and state was meant to separate religion from society. And we have yet to reassess the anti-Americanism, the self-hatred implicit in the attitude we have generally affected toward our country, that has led us into countless stupidities and worse. Let us give ourselves some credit. Through it all, we have preserved a rich sense of humor. The destruction of hierarchies, elites, and authority is to be effected through the concentration of power in a Leviathan state miraculously free of all such reactionary encumbrances. No wonder liberals are ready to absolve us from our sins without first hearing our confession. No wonder we are witnessing the virtual fusion of left liberalism and revolutionary radicalism in the wake of the collapse of the socialist countries. For most left-wing liberals share with radicals much the same ideology of personal liberation. Radicals and conservatives alike have always charged liberals with bad faith in refusing to carry out the logic of their own egalitarian and radical democratic premises. They have been right about the refusal, but not necessarily about the bad faith. There are more charitable explanations, including a healthy gut revulsion by humane liberals against the substitution of logical consistency for common decency and common sense. I have been piling up assertions and may be wrong on all counts. But am I wrong in believing that unless the left reopens these fundamental questions, it will have no future and deserve none? The deepest trouble with political correctness arises from its thinly disguised invitation to an endless repetition of crimes, atrocities, and worst of all, failures. Yes, worst of all the failures, for the deepening horror that Black America faces, to speak of no other impending horror, cannot be arrested by a morally bankrupt movement with an appalling record of political and economic failure, no matter how many Pyrrhic victories it piles up on deranged and degraded college campuses. The left has been right to fight for social justice. As Alexander Solzhenitsyn, no friend of ours, recently observed, Although the earthly ideal of socialism-communism has collapsed, the problems it purported to solve remain. The brazen use of social advantage and the inordinate power of money, which often direct the very course of events. Our indictment of class injustice, racism, and the denigration of women has not been rendered less urgent by the failure of socialism. The millions of our own martyred comrades who fought against those enormities need not have died in vain. But they will indeed have died in vain if we refuse to face our past squarely, subject our basic premises to stern review, own up to all that has gone wrong, and take the measures necessary to guarantee against the next round of the same old story. Well, there you have it, everybody. The Question by Eugene Genovese. Absolutely stunning, if you ask me. I hope you agree with me on that. I love that piece. And as I read, I thought, you know, I have so little to comment on here, because he says everything I would think to say. It's unbelievable. I remember I first read that. I guess I must have been in grad school by the time I found out about it. Came out in summer 94. I had just gotten out of college. And I just loved it. Because at Columbia, where I did my graduate work, I was surrounded by leftists. At Harvard, you could find some people who were, at least to one degree or another, in our camp. Not at Columbia. It was a difficult thing, let's just say, for a person like me to get through. Now, I'm a jovial guy. I'm an easy enough guy to get along with. So I didn't have trouble making friends on a superficial level. But it was a very, very lonely time, at least my first couple of years at Columbia were a very, very lonely time for me. So I thought, well, all the more time to work on my dissertation. So I did. I worked on my stuff. I got out of there quickly. I want to tell you what's coming up tomorrow. Remind you that you can read this article over at tomwoods.com/451. But I have just a couple things that I want to say before we finish up. A quick story from grad school, if I may. I was a PhD student in U.S. history. And the advice you're going to get from your academic advisor is you take courses in U.S. history, and that's it, because that's what your specialization is. But I thought, look, I have extra time. I could fit more work in. I'm not married. I don't have a family yet. I can't get along with anybody really here, which after a couple years, I did find a group and we got along great. But I was really, really single-mindedly working on academic work during those first couple of years. So I decided I want to take intensive Latin, two semesters of Latin crammed into one, because I thought an educated person needs to know Latin. That was the only reason. It had nothing to do with Latin liturgy. I was a Lutheran at the time, and that meant nothing to me. I just thought an educated person needs to know Latin. And my advisor told me, it was Richard Bushman, I don't know if he's still there, and he absolutely told me not to do it, that you got to focus on U.S. history. I said, yeah, I am doing that, but I have extra time too, and I'd like to do this. So they let me do it. I was the only U.S. historian in the class. Everybody else is a classics major, of course. And I remember that semester I saw the sun come up every single day because I was up so late working on my Latin, and I would go over to Hamilton Hall, named after Alexander Hamilton, to do my Latin course, and then I would come back and sleep a little bit more and then get up and do my PhD work and then repeat it every single day. Well, that's the kind of guy I am and guy I was, and so I did that. Well, then I decided I'd like to take some French. I want to learn French because, again, an educated person should know some French. I already know Spanish, and if I know some Spanish, French is a Romance language. I can just plug French grammar into that template that I already have in my mind. I'll be off to the races. So I get there. It's all undergraduate students and me. So who cares? I just want to learn French. They refuse to teach me the grammar. It's this fashionable thing. We're just going to bark French words at you on the idea that you learn languages at age, 25 the same way you learned them when you were 1.5. I don't buy that. I think at age 25, you need the structure of the language also. Well, all they would do is bark French words at me, and I'm begging them to teach me the grammar. I am begging them. Teach me the grammar. I already know how Spanish works. I just want to plug French into this. They wouldn't. I learned no French whatsoever, and it was a total waste of my time. Now, the reason I spent all this time telling you about this is that I did finally find a language program these days that teaches it to you the way I wanted to learn French in those days. And it is the company that I told you about at the beginning of the episode. It's Rocket Languages, because they teach you, they do bark some words at you to teach you through immersion, but they also teach you the structure of the language. Well, thank you. If only I could have had this 20 years ago, I would have known French then. But they teach it to you in this way, where you get the structure and the immersion. There's no other way for an adult to learn a language, and you can learn it very efficiently. You can learn it in your car. You can learn culture. You learn the language. You learn the structure. You learn the vocabulary. It's done very efficiently to minimize the amount of time you have to spend doing it. It's absolutely worth looking into. I wish I had had this when I was in grad school, and I wouldn't have been pulling my hair out learning no French whatsoever. You can get a free mini course to test them out and see if you like the way they teach languages, the way I like it. You can get a free mini course through tomwoods.com/rocket. Now, what's coming up tomorrow? Tomorrow, I'm going to talk to George Kalantzis, who is the author of an incredible study on early Christianity and the military. And if you think, well, I'm not a Christian, I have no interest in this, I'm telling you, I think this is one of the most interesting episodes I've done. I've already spoken to him. It's going to run tomorrow. It is very interesting because of the controversy among scholars who say, yes, it's true that the Christians didn't want to be in the military, but some of them will say the reason they didn't want to be in the military is because of the pagan religious overtones of the Roman military. It wasn't because they were pacifists or they were opposed to violence or whatever. But what Kalantzis shows is that is why they didn't do it, is that they were opposed to violence, and that you can't find anybody exhorting somebody to participate in the military out of civic duty or as some kind of out of the Christian vocation. You cannot find that at all. Very, very interesting conversation. So check that out tomorrow. Remember, of course, too, that if you've been itching to start that blog, I'll show you how to do it in 5 minutes, plus give you free publicity to get you some visitors over at that blog if you check out tomwoods.com/publicity before you start up the blog. Don't do anything until you look at tomwoods.com/publicity. It'll show you how to do it and how to get free publicity from me. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.